We will now look at texts from St. Thomas Aquinas that are of importance in our study of bioethics, particularly because St. Thomas Aquinas is the greatest systematic theologian that the Catholic Church has ever known, to put it quite bluntly. His writings, his opinions will be taken quite seriously by all late medieval and then modern thinkers as well. And therefore, he is of very, very great significance and influence. However, it's important for us to bear in mind that although we'll be looking at some very important and foundational reflections that he makes that are very positive, the one very problematic area is his adoption of Aristotle's understanding of life and animation in the human embryo and the human fetus, which would continue to influence thinkers for several centuries after his lifetime. It is not a heresy to admit that St. Thomas Aquinas was wrong on several significant theological points, such as this one. One can note other examples as well. He believed that, for example, the moment of ordination was not the laying on of hands. He believed it to be the imposition of the instruments that symbolized the order. That's an error that had to be corrected by an official papal decree, actually in the 20th century. And he also disbelieved in the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary. So it is perfectly permissible to acknowledge that St. Thomas Aquinas got it wrong on significant subjects and in particular areas without in any sense diminishing his stature and his significance and his importance as a theologian in the Catholic tradition. But it is important for us to be aware of this fundamental point and what he actually believe. It's not a question of trying to reinterpret Thomas and claim that he taught something else. We need to know what he actually taught, what he actually said, because this will be influential, and it will represent a point of discussion among theologians. It will influence the developing doctrine of the Church, and this approach will eventually be formally and specifically rejected by the Church. And in particular, as I've noted in our introduction, and this is a text that I've taken directly from our textbook, from Jones' Soul of the Embryo, from chapter 8. Aquinas represents one of a series of medieval thinkers who tried to use the philosophy of Aristotle to provide the Church with tools for doing theology in a consistent, clear, and logical fashion. But it was not only Aristotle's methodology, but his insights that were often appropriated. And in this case, C.S. Lewis reminds us, in the Middle Ages, if someone saw something written in a book and attributed to an author they respected, they tended to believe that it was true. So when St. Thomas Aquinas saw that Aristotle had taught that there was a distinction between the embryo at 40 days for males and 80 or 90 days for females, St. Thomas Aquinas would presume that this is a biological fact. This is something that one can trust Aristotle on, and effectively, that's what he did. So he concluded, and these are the conclusions that the texts we're about to look at will summarize. He concluded, number one, that there was a succession of different kinds of souls in the embryo. That at an initial stage, the embryo is vegetative. It has a vegetative soul. Then it becomes sensitive. It has an animal soul. But finally, at some point, and the point for him was 40 days for males and 90 or 80 for females, it acquires an intellectual, a human, or a soul corresponding to the intellectus, which is the deepest level of the human self for St. Thomas Aquinas. It corresponds to the Christian Greek theological tradition of the nous, the innermost self that bears the image of God. Now, this is not just the part of the self that is capable of rational thought, or what we might today call intellectual reason, although it certainly is the part of the self that is capable of that, but it is more specifically the part of the self, the soul, that is the image of God, that is a particular, that in a very special way is that which bears the divine image. So that which makes us truly human and capable of being saved, as contrasted, Aquinas would have said, with the animal or plant world, is something that happens at a stage in embryonic development. Now, notice, as has been noted by Jones in this second little point, the embryo is alive. That is not in question. It is alive and it has growth and nutrition, but the embryo is not specifically human life, according to Thomas Aquinas, until it reaches a certain stage of formation. And then the first nutritive and then animal souls that it has received is replaced by the intellectual or human soul, the soul capable of salvation and of eternal life with God, which for Aquinas, following Aristotle, as we've noticed, was 40 days for males and 80 or 90 for females. Now, this conviction, of course, would significantly influence later theologians, as we've noticed. So what I'd like for us to do is look briefly, and we may have occasion to come back to these texts at a later point during this course, but I did want you to have access to the texts, both in translation and in the original, because these tend to be misquoted and misused by opponents of the Catholic Church who would like to claim that the Church's teaching has changed or is not consistent, which is not the case. We believe in the development of doctrine, that God unfolds a deeper understanding of the truths of faith with the passing of time, and that this is articulated by the magisterium as it becomes clearer. And so Aquinas and the medievals reflecting on these traditions represent a stage in the development of Catholic doctrine. Undoubtedly, if Aquinas had lived in the era after Gregor Mendel and the discovery of the existence of chromosomes and the significance of genetics, his opinion would have been what the Church now teaches, that human life begins at conception. But he was using what science he had, and these are the conclusions to which he was led by what he regarded as the trustworthy scientists of his period. So if you drop down to number 421, this is the text, the famous text from the Summa Theologiae, in which he's discussing where the soul comes from. And it's a rather prolonged discussion. And in the course of it, he says, and I've highlighted the text, it has a nutritive soul from the beginning, then a sensitive or animal soul, and finally an intellectual, a fully human soul. And he concludes that when a more perfect form supervenes, the previous form is corrupted. So he's saying here, it isn't that you have three souls, but that you have three successive kinds of souls. And so he says that the intellectual soul is created by God. This is the last portion of this first text. At the end of human generation, the pre-existing forms no longer exist. Now, it isn't just in the question of reflecting on the nature of the human soul that Aquinas comes up with these convictions. It's also in meditation on the question of the soul of Christ. And here he concludes that, and he contrasts what must have happened with Christ, because the conviction there is that Christ becomes incarnate at the moment of his conception, and Christ must have been perfect. So Aquinas concludes that what happens to ordinary human embryos, this succession of souls, is not what happened in the case of Christ. He says that that because Christ's body was perfectly formed in a shorter space of time, so after a shorter space of time was it animated. So these convictions or conclusions about a succession of souls in human beings are raised and highlighted and in a certain sense called into question when we consider the issue of how then does Christ's soul differ from the soul of every other human being. Ultimately, the Church will say that just as Christ's soul, Christ's full self, was complete at the moment of his conception in the womb of the Blessed Virgin Mary, that's also true of every other human being. So in a way, Aquinas' speculation on this question would pave pave the way for a deeper and truer understanding of the nature of the completion or the humanness of the human embryo at a much later time in the Church's articulation of its teaching. And again, numbers 423 and 424 are simply more texts that are providing you with the primary source material for the conclusions that Jones has already listed, as we've noticed. Here in Summa Theologiae, number 4.2.3, Aquinas says that the body is successively and disposed for the soul, first as imperfectly, and then later perfectly. Then, in number 4.2.4, this is where he specifically quotes Aristotle. In others, that is to say, not in Christ, and this, by the way, is from his commentary on the Sentences of Peter Lombard, a text which everyone who was going to acquire a theological doctorate at this point in the Middle Ages had to comment on or write a commentary on as a part of what we would today call their doctoral dissertation or their doctoral thesis. Aquinas, in this collection of commentaries that he wrote, says, in others, he's referring here, describing Christ, but he says, in others, that is other human beings, the conception of the male is not complete until the 40th day, nor the female until the 90th. And one will find a certain variation based on texts of Aristotle that this is either the 90th or the 80th day for females, but again, that there is a perfection of conception, a completion of conception that doesn't take place until this point in embryological development, according to Aquinas, based on Aristotle. And here in number 4.2.5, he refers specifically to the animated fetus. That is, he refers to a fetus that has been that has received a soul, meaning has received a fully human soul. He's commenting on the text we've already looked at in Exodus, if one strikes a woman with child and she miscarries, and he is aware of this tradition that we saw particularly influential in Judaism, that there's a distinction between the formed and unformed embryo or fetus, but he's specifically here describing it as the fetus with a soul, meaning a human soul, and therefore acknowledging a difference in the moral culpability or the severity of the crime, depending on the stage of development. Again, the rest of these texts we'll be looking at, we can look at fairly briefly. I simply want us to be aware of them, that they do have foundation in Aquinas, and therefore will be influential as points of view for later theologians. He uses the term contra naturam, against nature, to describe sexual behavior that is not intended to result in generation. That is to say, any kind of intercourse that does not involve the possibility of generation. So he's not just talking about something like, oh, same-sex behavior here. He's talking about any kind of behavior that could take place, say, between a man and a woman that was not ordered towards the potential generation of new life. So when we speak of sex being contra naturam, it refers to anything that is not what the Church will today particularly call ordinatus, that is not ordered towards the possibility of fecundity, of new life, and of promoting union as well. So that's where he uses that phrase, and again, it becomes very important in the later tradition. In number 4.2.7, although we've noticed that Aquinas does make this distinction, nevertheless, it's important to note that for him, engaging in any kind of intercourse, and this will apply by extension also to the question of after intercourse, the embryo that is developing within the woman, that to destroy this or to engage in an act that is not ordered toward this is next after the sin of homicide. After the sin of homicide, post peccatum homicidii, this has a secundum locum tenere, that it has the second place. So this is also part of the tradition that develops within Catholicism, that matters concerning sexuality are always grave matter. They are always serious issues, because if they are not ordered towards what God has intended sex for, they have the potential for being very, very serious sins indeed. Number 4.3 we've already looked at the introduction to the course, Aquinas' text on double effect. This is in his section on homicide. We're now expanding beyond beginning of life to look at other end-of-life issues as well. He points out in this section on self-defense, as we've already noticed, that acts have multiple effects. And one's intention in engaging in an act is very significant, and one is not morally responsible, necessarily morally responsible. We've noted the conditions that apply to this for the secondary effects that take place if one engages in an act with two effects. Now, we don't need to review that in detail now. Let's drop down to number 4.4, a series of texts that will become important in later discussion concerning the end of human life. In particular, number 4.4.1 from the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas' statement that it is never lawful to slay the innocent. The taking of innocent life is always wrong. And that applies not only to innocent life from as we would today note, from conception onwards, but also the innocent life of, say, a handicapped person or a person at the end of life who's in a persistent vegetative state, someone whose life is not forfeit legally for some reason, their life cannot legitimately be ended directly or intentionally, whether through action or inaction. Number 4.4.2, this is a text on mutilation. And remember, surgery, amputation in particular, is a form of mutilation. It destroys a member, a part of the body. Is it lawful to engage in maiming, to mutilate someone? This would have been both a legal question, where maiming, mutilation would have been part of the secular legal code, but also it has to do with the question of, can one legitimately undertake medical procedures that will result in physical mutilation? And it can only be done if the health of the body cannot be maintained by any other way. Now, in the next section, number 4.4.3, this also is from the Summa Theologiae, goods necessary for life. This will later be invoked in reflections on the area of nutrition and hydration as being things which are necessary for life, and also the question of using or taking medicine. Note that he says, everyone has instilled in them by nature to love their own life, but in due measure. That is, one is not obliged to maintain one's life at all costs. One should not fear death. Death is the natural result of life in the world. But at the same time, one does have a responsibility to maintain one's life. And he says temporal goods are despised, they are to be rejected if they hinder us from loving and serving God. And that would include temporal goods like medicine or the things necessary to maintain life. But they are not to be despised or rejected insofar as they help us attain the things that pertain to divine fear and love, to live our lives in accordance with God's will and looking forward to the ends for which God created us. So there is not an absolute requirement to use means to sustain life at all costs, but only insofar as this is inappropriate to our natural ordering toward the love of God. So the last little text by Aquinas that I wanted us to look at, also from the Summa Theologiae, has to do with suicide. And he provides a meditation, a reflection, which will be important both in the theological and in the legal reflection on suicide. Why is suicide wrong? And as we mentioned earlier, in an earlier lecture, suicide has been regarded as acceptable in many cultures throughout the world as a response to dishonor or a means of avoiding dishonor, particularly having to do with honor codes connected with the military or with government. And Aquinas, following Augustine, following the early Christian tradition, says, no, it is not permissible to take one's own life. Why not? And he gives very specific reasons. Suicide is contrary, he says, to the inclination of nature, that is, the nature God has implanted within our hearts, and to the charity, the love which each person should have in loving themselves. Suicide, he says, is always a mortal sin, contrary to the natural law, and it is contrary to love. So it is always, always a serious sin. Now, remember, bear in mind, that he's speaking here of the act itself and its moral significance. Whether or not it has the effect of being a mortal sin will depend upon the intention and the knowledge that the individual who commits it has, and that's still the case today. Acts are not capable of having the effect of permanent and eternal separation from God simply in themselves. An act is not necessarily, does not have the consequences of mortal sin, which is in our tradition, separation from God that can only be restored through true penance and contrition. An act may be objectively, that is to say, in its nature, mortally sinful, without the individual themselves acquiring the full penalty according to a mortal sin, if they act out of ignorance of the church's teaching on this subject, or they do not possess full knowledge, or they are in their own intention so powerfully influenced, perhaps by rage or by fear, that they are not capable of acting in a rational fashion. So suicide, the act itself, has the character of a mortal sin for the first reason we've just looked at. But second, he says, because it injures the community. It's an act that affects not only the individual, but those around them. And psychologists today would absolutely agree with Thomas Aquinas on this point, that violent suicide, for example, is an act that scars the psyche of the families of those who engage in this act, and in particular has a terrible effect on those who have the misfortune to discover a person who has committed suicide in a violent way. It is a tremendously destructive act of violence against the community. And thirdly, theologically, spiritually, suicide is always wrong because life is God's gift to humankind, and it is only God who has the right to take that gift away. And he points out in the conclusion this, the passage from this life to another is subject not to the free will of a human being, but to the power of God. It is not for man to take his own life, that he may pass to a happier life, nor to escape any unhappiness whatsoever of the present life. So this would mean that Aquinas would not agree with any kind of suicide for the purpose of ending life to avoid suffering, whether physical suffering or emotional suffering.